Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.
My family thinks I'm crazy. A podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success.
I've been telling everybody that our government is shady. But every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens invading. Fluoride in the water, they spray our skies daily. When I talk about these things, they think I'm crazy. There's no escaping anymore, the evil that we're facing. Illuminati mind control, they're sacrificing babies. The end of days, but anyways, my family thinks I'm crazy.
What, they don't want to listen to you? No, they don't want to listen. They don't want to hear it. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with your
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know. If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You'll just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
We know Napoleon had a weird experience inside the pyramid when he was in Egypt. Okay? Real weird experience, and it could have had something to do with a psychotronic experience inside the pyramid where he got a glimpse, okay, interdimensionally, across time and space. Crazy as it sounds, would he have been interested in a portal? You betcha. Absolutely, in my opinion. Now, here's the interesting thing. In the Rennes-La Chateau milieu, there is the Hopewell family. Madame de Hopewell is the one whose grave marker, headstone, is mysteriously associated with the Rennes-La Chateau mystery because it's the one with the Et in Arcadia ego phrase on it and the whole cross and the weird symbol. But what's interesting is, I believe he was a nephew, might have been a cousin, but a nephew, a blood relative who would have been, I'm pretty sure, a contemporary of hers, she would have known, was Colonel de Hopewell. And Colonel de Hopewell was a close confidant officer serving under Napoleon, who was on the Egyptian expedition.
You just heard today's guest, who's a professional investigator of historical occult mysteries, an author of pulp fiction novels, and a screenwriter who has appeared on History Channel's Ancient Aliens. He joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy this conversation with Walter Bosley. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast, recently listed in podcastmillion.com's top 100 conspiracy podcasts. I think we ranked 39. So big thank you to all of you tuning in. And I know you're going to love today's guest. He is, in my opinion, a fixture in the community. He's written at least a dozen excellent books that show a side of history that few know about and few learn about in the traditional sense. So without further ado, Walter Bosley, welcome back to the show. It's always a pleasure to have an author of your pedigree on the show. But for folks who might be new to your work, give us a little overview of what you've been up to recently and maybe even your latest book.
Ah, well, That's all over the place is the answer for that. My most recent book is the follow-up to my Esoteric Napoleon, Volume 1. This is Esoteric Napoleon, Volume 2. Got that busy cover, but we, you know, went with busy this time on this one. But this was long awaited, not just by readers of the first one, but by myself. I've been wanting to get to this one for a while, and I finally did. I wrote a book boy, just in the last year and a half, I've done three. This book here, of course, is the most recent. Right before that, I did, or last summer, I did one called The Time Travelers, or The Time Travel Guidebook. Yeah, The Time Travel Guidebook. I'm looking to see if I had a copy handy. I don't have one at arm's reach, but that one is, you know, kind of a fun approach to one of my favorite topics of all time. And it gives it suggests a method of trying time travel yourself, if you're so inclined. But it's the kind of book where you can just have fun with it, you know, not take it seriously. And before that, I did one titled NIMSA, How America Sold Her Soul. That one about a year and a half ago now. And that one was a follow-up to, you know, we talked about the Sonora Aero Club and my research on that. And those familiar with that, if they'll remember, Charles Delshow was the guy who's our original source and really sole source on the Sonora Aero Club. And he talked about them being sponsored by this group headquartered in Germany, this group called NIMSA, N-Y-M-Z-A. And as my readers know, my research, I've tied the threads of the 1850s Sonora Aero Club affiliated NIMSA to the rise of Nazi Germany. And that thread goes through the 1890s airship mystery and exotic technology and occult science circles, that kind of thing. So people were asking me, well, what happened to NIMSA after the Nazi era? And NIMSA, How America Sold Its Soul, is my answer to that question. What I think went on with NIMSA beyond World War II. And that's probably my most conspiratorial book I've written. And it even talks about things in modern politics today, which within the theme of what the book's about, but I rarely go there, as you know. I like to look at historical things in the past, but I couldn't avoid it with this NIMSA book. So as you can see, between following up on the NIMSA thread and that historical thing and time travel, and then what I propose is the lost Vedic civilization, you know, an ancient precursor to what we know as India, a lost Vedic civilization being the possible answer to these mystery civilizations, the megalith builders, you know, in the Americas, that kind of thing. In this book, Esoteric Napoleon II goes into that, specifically where the Louisiana Territory is concerned. So, you know, just been jumping around history and weird subjects.
Well, it's a lot to keep track of, so I'll do my best to guide our course today. But you just left us on a good path to start. And when it comes to the Vedic pre-flood culture, that's fascinating. Where does that connect to Napoleon's interest in Egypt? Because I know Esoteric Napoleon I kind of takes the Rennes Le Chateau mystery and maybe finds a connection there between the French's expedition into, or the, you know, France's expedition into Egypt.
Yes, that was a major part of the story of Napoleon Bonaparte. Napoleon was always interested. He was interested in India very much so, particularly, I think, after the Egyptian campaign. Egypt was important back in the 18th century, early 19th century, because remember, Napoleon did that expedition to Egypt in the last 2 years of the 18th century, so going into the early 19th. Egypt was looked at by the European powers and England, Britain, as the road to India, right? They were all ultimately wanting to get to and interact with and maybe even control India. So they looked at Egypt as the way to get there. Well, France was interested in keeping England out of India as long as possible. So they approved Napoleon's plan to go down and do a campaign of exploration, you know, conquest, if it worked, in Egypt. And Napoleon was more interested in archaeology and ancient civilizations than he was, you know, keeping England out of India, although he was all for that too. You know, England was no friend of his. So after the Egyptian campaign and what Napoleon and his scientists, he took more scientists on that, you know, what was ostensibly a military campaign than anyone since Alexander the Great did the same thing, took scientists, thinkers, philosophers, you know, they were called the savants during Napoleon's expedition to Egypt. And there were just hundreds of them, actually maybe a couple of thousand. And this is where modern Egyptology has its roots, is in the Napoleonic expedition. Well, this just confirmed Napoleon's interest in the whole lost civilization theme. And after that, he was really keen on diplomatic relations and an association to India, because he was fascinated with their secrets and their influence. And of course, their resources. Napoleon was also practical. I don't want to give an impression that he was just all, you know, philosophical and he fell into being this great military commander. No, that came naturally to him. He was brilliant. He's still studied to this day as a military tactician. So when I dug into another topic that had always made me very curious, when I delved into the mysteries of the Louisiana Territory and Louisiana Purchase, because if you know your history, Napoleon Bonaparte sold the Louisiana Territory to the United States in 1803 after getting it back from Spain, who had it for a brief time. He gets it back from Spain and sells it to the United States in 1803. However, what we learn in the biographical study of Napoleon is that in 1802, he ordered his naval secretary to send a secret expedition under and keep it under secrecy. That was his instruction, into the Louisiana Territory to explore for something that wasn't identified. Okay. Now, when you think that the Lewis and Clark expedition, which was the American expedition that Thomas Jefferson sent out, they took, my gosh, over 2 years to do an exploration of the Louisiana Territory. Clearly, Napoleon, in my opinion, was looking for something specific to only have this expedition be out there. As far as we know, he only had a window of less than a year for his secret team to find whatever it was he was looking for. So, you know, I wondered, okay, when I look at Napoleon's personal interests in ancient civilizations, and when I consider all the clues we who are enthused with the lost civilization theme know about in the Americas, the megalith builders, you know, you have Pumapunku and Tiahuanaco and all these, you know, strange places down in South America in particular, but also in North America. You know, I wondered, okay, you have the mysteries of the mound builders here. And of course, you have Cahokia, which is technically outside the Louisiana Territory proper, but it's close enough that anybody exploring Louisiana Territory could have, you know, taken a little side trip up there. And I argue that Napoleon's secret team certainly did. And there's practical reasons for that. I also argue that Meriwether Lewis did these kinds of things too, and probably went to Cahokia. You see, Cahokia had been in French hands for a couple of hundred years. French trappers, okay, had established a village there, a trade village. So it had been greatly controlled and accessed by the French long before Napoleon came along. So I discuss in the book, Esoteric Napoleon II, the idea that there were French agents within these trappers and hunters who were actually there exploring these mysterious sites for over a century. So between the reports they would have sent back to France and Napoleon's own research and interest, you know, I think Napoleon had a particular thing in mind he was looking for. And I argue that it would have had to do with these mysterious, you know, again, the mounds, which most of the mounds are outside the Louisiana Territory proper. But the fact that they are there in the rest of the, you know, the east and the southeast, and that Cahokia is just north of Louisiana Territory proper, I think that was a motive for Napoleon to send people in to see what was in the Louisiana Territory. If we have all these mystery mounds in, you know, adjacent territories, right? And we have Cahokia in an adjacent territory, what's in the Louisiana Territory? And what were they looking for specifically? Now, At the same time, we have 2/3 of the French Navy in you know, adjacent resources deployed to the Caribbean. There is the uprising in San Domingo that's going on, but he didn't need 2/3 of his naval force. When we look at the history more closely, we find out, and this is all documented. Excuse me. Sorry about that. A little dry air in here today. We find out that Napoleon at the time was pushing for the diplomatic relations with India, okay? And he planned to use the Caribbean as the launching staging area for expeditions to India. So he could avoid, he wouldn't have to go the Mediterranean. He wouldn't have to go the Egyptian route. He was just going to go the old Vasco da Gama route, right? Down the Pacific, you know, around the Horn of Africa or the Cape down there in Africa and into the Indian Ocean. Okay. He was going to go around. So that was the real reason why 2/3 of the naval force was deployed to the Caribbean. Okay. And so with that as historical fact, okay, that's not suggestion or hypothesis. You have to figure, okay, could what he was looking for in the Louisiana Territory have had any kind of bearing on this pursuit of a diplomatic relation with India? In other words, what if he had found, say, a relic or a site that was clearly Vedic, ancient Vedic in its origin? He could go to India with this as an overture. Look what my explorers have found in America. Look what they brought back. This is clearly, you know, Vedic. Or we found, you know, a site, a temple, a lost structure. Here's a sketch and a painting of it. You know, this would have been great for some type of overture to India. So because we know that at the time, 1802, he was planning on using the Caribbean as this staging area for expeditions to India, because we know he was fascinated with these kinds of lost ancient civilizations, and because we know there are archaeological mysteries in North and South America, I put forth a hypothesis that there was this lost Vedic civilization that left its colonies and its structures and an evidence of its existence in the Americas. Now, the idea that there's a lost Vedic civilization is not my original idea. What I'm saying is, I think it's a great possible explanation for these archaeological mysteries in the Americas.
Wow. And there's so much in the way of suppressed or just plain forgotten history when it comes to North America's relics and strange sites. I mean, up here in New England, we have hundreds of stone chambers that are just sort of written right off as root cellars. Meanwhile, if you actually try to put your vegetables in there over winter, they'll come back moldy. So really, I mean, that explanation, who knows? Maybe I don't have the right straw, but I've tested it myself, and it you know, you put something in there and it's not exactly going to store. So I don't know how much the, you know, we know truly about these sites, and if they do go as far back as the Bronze Age, as people like Barry Fell have said, then maybe there's a whole different multicultural history of North America that we're just not told about, or maybe just too disconnected from to fully understand.
Right. Well, and one of the things that encouraged me in this direction with this was that legendary popular tale about the mystery city, the necropolis, it's described in some ways, inside the Grand Canyon, which the you know, the Department of Interior is not letting us know about, and the Smithsonian hid the relics from. And you've all heard the story. It's from a 1909 newspaper in Arizona, where this scientist named Jordan and the Smithsonian affiliates found this lost ancient, is how they described it, city inside a canyon, inside caverns and tunnels. And the way they described it was, it it's kind of Asian. It's kind of Egyptian, but not quite. Well, when you learn about what's called the Cham or Cham Empire, okay, very much a historical thing. They were this Thessalocratic, or I prefer to use the easier word, maritime civilization, seagoing. And they were all over Asia, Southwest and Southeast Asia, spanning from Egypt all the way across India, what is Thailand and Vietnam, Cambodia, all that, Australia, all of that into the Pacific Islands and South America, the shores of South America. So why couldn't they have reached the shores of North America? And why couldn't that city that was found have been established as kind of a colony of the Cham Empire, this very well-known, historically documented empire, okay? And when you look at the culture of the Cham Empire, it was a blend of Egyptian, Hindu, and the Pacific and cultures and the Southeast Asian cultures. So if you blend all those, particularly with the Hindu and the Egyptian mixed together, you're going to have what was described in this 1909 article about maybe kind of an Egyptian. It was as if they didn't know about the particular individuals, just wasn't connecting this city with something like the Cham Empire. So the best they could do was use the term Egyptian as kind of a catch-all, when actually it was a little bit more of a blend than that. And there's no better explanation for this Grand Canyon Mystery City than Cham Empire explorers. So if the Cham Empire reached the shores of North America centuries ago, you know, over 1,000, whatever it was, if they reached here and built a colony, how might they have known to get here or that there was anything here? Well, if they were a descendant culture of this lost Vedic culture, they might be in possession of their charts and maps and their knowledge of the rest of the world, because this lost Vedic civilization, if you look at the material that talks about it, was global in its nature. When you look at the Indian sources, East Indian, you know, from India, the scholars on this stuff and their historical literature that talks about this empire, they are the first to tell you, don't think of the lost Vedic empire as India. We, India, they say, they write, we are a descendant culture of this lost Vedic empire. We are merely the one that remains that is the most like that Vedic empire, but we're not exactly. It's like they say, you know, we're like the version of that Vedic empire that developed on our subcontinent, is what they'll tell you. So that they say, don't make the mistake of when you say lost Vedic empire, it's just like, you know, folks and culture from India specifically as we know it. No, it was something that predated that. And so I thought, wow, okay, if they were global and if the Cham Empire maybe had the benefit of the knowledge of this lost empire that guided them, you know, told them, hey, there's these other continents there that we came to call North America and South America. Well, that could suggest that this lost Vedic empire, you know, had outposts here or had, you know, established here as well. So with Napoleon's interest, Napoleon's very specific interest in interacting with India and on and so forth, and all the other things I mentioned, it made sense to me to propose the possibility that this lost Vedic empire indeed left behind relics and such here. And sure enough, when you look at the Lewis and Clark expedition, there's interesting pieces of art, sketches of structures that they swore they saw and found that later we're told, oh, that was just the shapes of rocks that they mistook for ancient structures. And you're like, you know, when I'm looking at the artwork that was done on these shortly after by subsequent explorers that went there, followed the same path as Lewis and Clark expedition, I'm like, that, no, some of that looks like rocks, but not all of it. And so I think, I argue, you know, in this book and like I have in others, that it's suppression. There's some benefit that, you know, they get out of suppressing the idea that this lost Vedic civilization may indeed have existed. I think it's ethnocentrism. You know, the West is really full of itself, thinking that it's the greatest thing ever in the history of humankind.
Yeah.
You know, we're pretty amazing. We're products of the West, but you know, that's rather arrogant to make such a big assumption like that, that you were, you know, the only game in town as far as civilization goes.
Right.
That usually, I think, precedes your fall pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Funny. Cause it does seem like it's the Latin or Roman strain of Western culture that has such hubris, but I'm curious if there is a connection to European cultures through the Vedic diaspora, just through the suffix. I'm thinking Gaelic, Nordic, Vedic, like there's the And what else comes to mind? The other thought that comes to mind is in the South Pacific, there are stories of white-skinned, very large men on remote islands that the Maori interacted with before they colonized New Zealand. And these are sort of legends now that don't, you know, they're not much more than fairy tales as far as scholars, you know, what they take for them. But yeah, I've heard these stories of, you know, people who don't seemingly fit into, you know, the traditional schema of where humans have been settling.
Sure. And, you know, I think that this Vedic idea, this lost Vedic civilization, remember, this is tied into, there's Atlantis, you know, and then there's what probably explains Atlantis. And I do think that's an advanced, technologically advanced civilization lost to us for the most part. There are people that know, of course. And I think this lost Vedic civilization I'm talking about is part of that whole, you know, basis for whatever the Atlantis and Lemuria. Now, I know Lemuria as such, that word that comes from the Blavatsky era, but, you know, I prefer to say like the old Rama Empire, that kind of, you know, when you talk about the advanced technologies in the Mahabharata and the Vedas and things like that, I think they're referring to this level of civilization that existed and the particular cultures that built it and wielded it. Okay. So I see this lost Vedic empire as probably the rivals to whatever Atlantis was, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, I get asked about Tartaria, you know, have been over the years, and there's much in popular Tartaria theory that is foolish and ignorant. And I've demonstrated that before, you know, in videos and on other people's shows and stuff, that, you know, it has taken me like 12 minutes to completely shoot down one ridiculous claim about something. Oh, this was a long time ago. Literally took me 12 minutes to find the absolute proof that that's not what that was. And another time, I think 7 minutes was another one. And these had to do with some housing tract that was going to be built out in the desert here in the Mojave.
Right.
And the other one had to do with the Parthenon in Nashville, Tennessee.
Yeah. You know, well, I had a suspicion that's what you're about to say. And I'm with you for the most part. I think a lot of it is a whole bunch of hubbub about nothing in these.
Right.
There's a few strains of it that are compelling enough to get the rest of the, you know, nonsense credibility.
Yeah. And, you know, I've been asked over the years, I'm honest. I'm not going to, you know, blow smoke up anyone's, you know, tail end just to, you know, just to make friends. You ask me about something, I'm going to look into it. I'm going to tell you what I find. However, there's a big fat, however. I've told the Tartaria people that have come, you know, that have talked with me and asked me about these things, I've said, I think you guys are onto something. Yes. But the route you're taking is this weird route that's you're going down paths that are going to be dead ends, and to stubbornly and smugly stick to that, that's not helping. So I think that I suggest that the idea of this lost Vedic empire could be the actual thing that they're seeing and looking for, you know, because there's evidence other than claiming that buildings clearly built in the late 19th century, you know, for crying out loud, people,
right?
And just denying whenever somebody presents the proof or evidence. You know, I've heard the equivalent of, I know you are, but what am I, response. And that is, well, were you there when they built it, dude? No, it was 150 years ago. Well, then you don't know, man. I'm like, oh, who has seen The Matrix too many friggin' times without saying they've seen The Matrix too many times? But as frustrating as the nonsense can be, I still say, guys, you're on to something. Just find the better path to get you there, because you're the Tartaria thing is very, very interesting. And it is kind of in the wheelhouse of what we're talking about. I just hate to see people, you know, go down the stubborn, goofy road.
Yeah. Well, and I think if anything, it's targeted propaganda to get people to look in the wrong direction for that exact effect, the cul-de-sacking effect, where you could have made it down the road to find the truth, but you got stuck in this cul-de-sac somewhere along the way, and now you're stubborn about it. And you see that in all different types of conspiracy theories, even the JFK lore. But when it comes to the old world stuff, the sunken buildings is just asinine. This idea that there are, you know, clearly 19th century buildings under the ground and then dug out, like, these are obviously fitting with the style of the time, but there are things underground in America that are worth digging up. And part of me feels like that's what this is meant to discredit. You know, in the Ohio River Valley, there's several different sites along with the Serpent Mound where metallurgy has been found to have taken place well before the timetable suggests the people here would have had that kind of technology, right? So right there is at least some sort of advanced culture, maybe advanced enough to smelt their own knives, not exactly flying machines, but it's still something more than what archaeologists admit.
Oh, yeah. And I'll even throw a bone to folks who think it was more than just, you know, that level. I think the level you're talking about that's more advanced than they generally are comfortable with admitting, 1,000 or whatever years ago, I think that is a kind of a gap, one of the gap fillers between this lost civilization. Because I'm open to the idea this lost civilization had flying machines, okay? Had powered vessels crossing the seas, had some type of what we would call telecommunications. There's something, you know, that is an example of what we're talking about. Now, I enjoy the heck out of seeing, again, you, God bless you, Tartaria folks, you do come up with some interesting things if you're listening or watching. This idea that the peaked features and towers and weird metallic things that a lot of people call lightning rods were actually some type of, you know, communication stations. That idea, I don't agree with the examples that they show, but again, there's an idea that I think they're onto. Look at the works of Joseph Farrell and Scott DeHart, particularly the book, I think it's Grit of the Gods, and another one is one of Joseph Farrell's Cosmic War books, where they talk about this very specific thing, that structures being built to be actual communication relay stations. Particularly some of these Gothic cathedrals had the ancient lost knowledge that had been captured during the Fourth Crusade. Okay, and then the Templars start building these things and they learn to communicate. And the idea that this was even done by the pyramid builders, and they provide the specifics as to how this could work and how this could be. And I think the folks that are saying, hey, these buildings in the 19th century, that they ought to read Grit of the Gods, because it would, I think they would find it really fascinating. And because I think there's something to this idea. So we're talking about, hypothetically, a civilization that was at that level, but for it to be mostly forgotten and then easy enough to suppress so it becomes completely forgotten, it had to have been a very long time ago. You know, as you said, pre-flood, pre-disaster, pre-cataclysm. whatever the case may be.
Yeah, I think there is a few issues that are glaringly obvious with the whole old world, but I'm glad to hear you say that, because yeah, there's a deeper intuitive sense behind that investigation that isn't necessarily wrong, although it might be being applied in the wrong ways. So one of the big, I guess, points that folks in this community make, did we lose you? No, just your camera.
Nope.
Okay. One of the big, you know, to pivot off of the old world topic back to our esoteric Napoleon discussion, yeah. You know, the suggestion is that the Freemasons and secret societies, they are aware of these sort of historical battles between these ancient civilizations, and they're somehow maybe a part of this lineage and maybe a faction of it, and that's why they're helping cover this up or just keep the truth suppressed. And I read that Thomas Jefferson might have played a role in this French expedition, or at least had some sort of idea that it was going on.
Well, I think that it's very possible that he knew about it. He and Napoleon Bonaparte were of the same mind when it came to their interest in history and archaeological curiosities. It wouldn't surprise me if Jefferson knew that Napoleon had sent that expedition in there. Napoleon might have even told him. What's interesting is how Jefferson followed up after Napoleon sold the territory to him. He hires Meriwether Lewis over a year before the expedition begins. He identifies Lewis as a personal secretary, but while Jefferson's off away from Monticello most of the time doing what he's doing, you know, being president, Lewis isn't in D.C. with him. Lewis is at Monticello the whole time with unfettered access to Thomas Jefferson's personal library, which at the time was the biggest personal library in North America. Okay. And with Jefferson's interest, you know, Meriwether Lewis was having a field day with that. So the instructions that he gives Meriwether Lewis, they hire Clark. Okay. And when you read the journals, it's like Clark is running the expedition. It's mostly Clark and the boys went and looked at this or found that or documented this, that, or the other. Sacagawea showed, you know, Clark this location, that location. You don't really learn or hear much about what Sacagawea was telling Lewis. See, she could have been telling Lewis about other things, and I think she was, because Lewis, when you read Clark's account, you're reading a lot of this. Captain Lewis went off with three guys, same trusted three guys, for a week, or they returned after 10 days. Or it's like, well, what was Captain Lewis doing? And then when you see what Meriwether Lewis turned in as his journal entries, you're thinking there's no way that this consumed all, you know, even the, you know, the walking or whatever, getting there. There's no way that consumed all those days he was gone. What else was he doing? Well, we have a clue, because from the very get-go, we know for a fact, this is from letters in the National Archives, Thomas Jefferson instructed Lewis, when you find things that should not be reported publicly, you communicate to me directly and you use this cipher. Jefferson provided him with a private cipher code to be used only between them for private letters whenever Lewis found something that shouldn't be discussed just with anybody. So Thomas Jefferson sent Meriwether Lewis on a secret mission. Okay, yeah, he was on the expedition, but his job was to go find stuff that he wasn't supposed to report in the journal or publicly. And with Jefferson's interest, with all this stuff with Napoleon leading up, I mean, what do you think he was looking for? It could be argued gold mines. Oh, just look for gold mines. Look for gold mines. And I could see why any nation, but particularly a young nation like the U.S. was at that time, wanted to keep sources of gold secret. Duh, that's a no-brainer. But that, I disagree that that was the end-all be-all of this secrecy. And I wonder what is still remaining hidden in archives known or unknown of Thomas Jefferson's. We have to remember, too, that, what was it, 3 years after the end of the Lewis and Clark expedition, Meriwether Lewis dies under very mysterious circumstances, which, by the way, in an officially sanctioned forensics analysis of the Meriwether Lewis death was conducted in the 1990s, and it was determined the man was murdered.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors. First and foremost, Vibe Med X. If you are interested in Shilajit as a holistic nutritional supplement, you are in luck. My man Ron is the original Shilajit importer. I believe he has been importing Shilajit before. It was trendy before anyone else even knew what Shilajit is or was. So check it out. Shilajit is something we're going to be talking about when Ron joins me on the show. But if you're already aware of all of the health benefits, go and give it a try at vibemedx.com and use the promo code CRAZY at checkout. Next up, we've got BrainSupreme.co. And speaking of nutrition, Brain Supreme has a nootropic supplement with that magic ingredient that we all know and love that'll help you really tap into a positive and beneficial microdosing regimen. If you want to learn more about microdosing, go to brainsupreme.co or listen to my interviews with the founder and CEO, Adam Schell, who proudly vouches for Brain Supreme. He takes it, I take it. It's a wonderful way to microdose and get an edge creatively in whatever realm of work, recreation, you're challenging yourself, whether it's exercise or a mental or wellness goal that you wish to achieve. Microdosing might be the step towards accomplishing your goal. So check it out at brainsupreme.co and use the promo code CRAZY at checkout. And last but not least is Above Phone. Get ahead of all this dastardly digital technical treachery where these data companies are brokering your private information for their own personal gain. And worst of all, they're selling you out to intelligence agencies, and worse, criminals, maybe criminals within our own government. I mean, this is not a good place to be keeping private or sensitive information. So go above all of that with Above Phone and their full lineup of phones, tablets, and laptops. I am now privileged to have my own Above Phone and Above Laptop, which I am using to stay above and beyond all of this surveillance that is going on the web. So if you're interested in learning more about Above Phone, check out my interview with Hakeem Anwar, and also go and check out their website, abovephone.com. And you know what I'm about to say, use the promo code CRAZY to save at checkout. You support yourself by getting ahead of the curve and going beyond all of this spying that is going on right in the palm of your hand. Your own phone is spying on you. No more with Above Phone. Learn more at abovephone.com. Support our sponsors and you support the show. You support yourself. Check out our full list of affiliate sponsors in the episode description. You can use the promo code CRAZY with all of them to save, whether you're picking up a HIIT kit, an Aqua Cure, some Organite. We've got so much to offer the affiliate codes, so go and check all of that out. And we'll be right back to this conversation with Walter Bosley after a quick break to our dynamic ads. Remember, if you want every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast ad free and interruption free, sign up on patreon.com/mftic. That's patreon.com/mftic. Wherever you browse the web, you will be in on the club. You get the premium content, the exclusive RSS feed with all the bonus episodes and access to video content, so much more. I'll see you over there, and we'll be right back after this quick break. When life's song falters in the night and courage seems to drown, hymns lifts your spirit anew so desires can fully abound. For strength and passion to reign supreme when love's dance calls to play, hymns offers remedies that ignite your flame and help extend your stay. If dormant flames in passion's den leave your heart feeling withdrawn, hymns fuels the fire with ease and care, reviving where it's gone. When tailored cures to fan the spark, no doctor's door you need to seek, reclaim your confidence and zest through hymns' discreet technique. For men who face such silent storms within the heart's domain, hymns ushers comfort quietly with solutions that remain. Holy online bespoke to you, removing burdens, lightening strain. Renew yourself with whispered ease. Let passion's song again be free. Start your free online visit today at hymns.com/crazy. That's hims.com/crazy for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/crazy. The featured products include compounded products which are not approved nor verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality by the FDA. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you about my favorite new sponsor. That's Mood. I love Mood because they're providing affordable, accessible, convenient, and transparent cannabis that's 100% legal and grown on small, pesticide-free American farms. That's right, American cannabis for American listeners. And it's 100% legal. They've got a full selection of cannabis products. I was a huge fan of their Tangy flower. Wow, it really brought me back to when I first tried Tangy, and it was incredible. So if you have any doubts, try Mood for yourself, and I doubt you'll be disappointed. Use the promo code CRAZY and get 20% off your first order at mood.com. That's 100% federally legal cannabis, pesticide-free, delivered directly to your front door in a discreet package. Mood.com, promo code CRAZY, and trust me, folks, you're going to love this stuff. I give it the Mystic Mark guarantee. And Mood is going to back that up because not only do they stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you get 20% off your first order with promo code CRAZY.
And, you know, it's another one of those things where what was the possible reason that he was murdered?
Now, before that conclusion was made, what was it? Was the jury just...
Oh, that it was suicide. Okay, this was like, who was the guy that they made the movie about, Don't Shoot the Messenger, or he was the guy that was the LA Times reporter investigating the CIA and the crack, and he ends up being, you know, executed, you know, but they say it's a suicide, shooting himself three times in the back of the head or something.
Right.
It was one of those kinds of things where it was an impossible, he shot himself and stabbed himself, and frenzy of, you know, suicide that Meriwether Lewis allegedly, you know, performs. And for the longest time, yep, it was suicide. And even Jefferson, I think Jefferson was hiding something when even he said, yeah, that's too bad about Meriwether. Yeah, I think it was suicide. I think he knew more, and if they were willing to kill Lewis over this, would they kill, you know, Jefferson had to wonder, would they kill him over something that was found? So what was found? What the heck was going on here? It's a big mystery, I think, still.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, if you had to wager a guess though, you know, as far as what Jefferson might have been concerned about, what do you think that might have been? I mean, we've heard rumors on the show of things like, you know, Chinese civilization or communities rather on the West Coast. We have the whole saga of Francis Drake going up the West Coast. So maybe they were worried they'd find some sort of, you know, enemies. Is that maybe possibly what they were concerned with? Or?
That, you know, that could have been, you know, in the mix for sure. But one of the things they might have been concerned with would be anyone else's claim to the territory, you know, and that would include, right. I mean, remember Thomas Jefferson, I am pretty sure it's Thomas Jefferson is the one who introduced John Adams to the study of, you know, the subject of, you know, Hinduism in India. Hmm. You know, you can see this in the letters. And so Jefferson was already interested in India. Okay, and the Vedic history. So did he think, you know, like Napoleon, that there was some type, or did he learn from Napoleon, you know, this suspicion that there might be a remnant of this lost Vedic civilization to which India, particularly back then in the early 19th century, would have been the logical beneficiary of culturally, you know, the way they looked at things back then. So
was there any... Was there any notion, and I know this is kind of just a historical coincidence that we call the Native Americans or did at one point Indians, but was there any suspicion that the Indians were related to the subcontinent of India? It kind of seems like maybe just a coincidence of the appellation.
Well, there are no coincidences when it comes to this kind of stuff. At the time, I don't know the extent of it, but in our times... I recommend a short, quick read book by a guy named Gene Matlock titled The Last Book on Atlantis You'll Ever Need to Read. That's the title. And he just is one of those that digs into an analysis of some Native American linguistics that are a dead match for words in Sanskrit and Hindi and things like that. So he argues... Yeah, there was ancient Vedic travel. I say Vedic, they say ancient Hindu travelers. There's multiple scholars on this, been around long before me. I just find it intriguing, and I think there's definitely something to it.
Yeah.
But at the time, you could probably argue that, yeah, if we can look at Napoleon and reasonably suggest that he was suspicious of this, certainly, why not Jefferson? I would venture to say Jefferson probably did suspect this. And maybe Thomas Jefferson thought, well, maybe, you know, the United States needs to have a relationship with India because of the various resources. Remember, spice is a very valuable thing. It particularly was back then. It was a currency. So, you know, the young United States could have benefited very well from diplomatic relations with India. So, maybe Jefferson was had in mind to do the same thing that Napoleon was interested in. I don't know. Find some type of tie and play that up to make India an ally. Interesting that it also turns out that India comes under the iron fist of England and eventually has to fight for their independence from England. And of course, we had done that. So imagine if Jefferson had established a strong relationship with India and, you know, invited them, you know, to the territory,
right?
To have, you know, a presence there. You know, England would have loved that.
Well, and if his eyes were on India, surely theirs were already too. And
they were. They had been venturing into India before.
Well, and I believe Fort Madras was the British East India Company. I mean, that was well before a lot of the colonies had established themselves in the East Coast, because Yale University, which I've been studying quite a bit, they got their first endowment and their namesake from Elihu Yale, who was a British officer of the East India Company, the British East India Company. So, wow.
I just did an episode on my channel with Professor Thomas Henry Horan, and we had a really good discussion on the company, the idea, you know, which includes the British East India Company and this corporate statism, or this corporate satellite idea of really what is essentially governmental type control over things. And it's really interesting how far back the idea of the company goes. So based on that, I would wholeheartedly agree with you that, you know, yeah, this was England's design. If the British East India Company is involved with something, yeah, that's their design to get their deep hooks into it.
Right. And Jefferson, famously a Republican against the sort of Federalist faction of founding fathers who seem to want to either ally themselves with England or just mimic England and become this federal power. And Thomas Jefferson was not interested in that. Maybe that's part of why he wanted diplomatic relations with India and all these other nations so that they could, you know, have a sort of sovereignty among equals.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting period in American history when the whole Federalist, anti-Federalist debate was going on. You know, this is why it kind of cracks me up when I see Alexander Hamilton, you know, Broadway musical, put forth as some great, wonderful guy, you know, a champion of the people, when he was one of the biggest elitist a-holes in American history.
Right.
He would not, folks, he did not have respect for the folks who see him as some type of, you know, shining beacon, you know, of humanity. He was one of these that, you know, wanted us to be, you know, essentially a kingdom, a monarchy, you know, whether he said it in those words or not, that, you know, that was the kind of guy he was. He was very much a central banker. Jefferson was opposed to, you know, a lot of these ideas. So interesting period in history. And who knows, that faction, you know, the central bankers, globalists, might have had a hand in Lewis's murder, you know, and that certainly would have got Jefferson's attention as far as concern for his own safety.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Now,
and I say that, let me add in there, is sure. that you find out that Nicholas Biddle, who, look up that guy, major proponent of central banking, major minion of Alexander Hamilton, he gets himself selected to be the editor of the Lewis and Clark Expedition journals, the official publication, and his qualifications and his interests are nothing to do with that particular job. So I argue in my book and in Esoteric Napoleon I, that Biddle was there on behalf of the central banker global elitists who were wondering, what's Jefferson really looking for? What was Meriwether Lewis really sent to find? And I think that's what Biddle got himself on there, because he didn't do the actual most of the editing. He's editor in name, but he's a questionable figure. So there that suggests the elitist central banker globalists, okay, the deep staters of their day, right? That establishes their interest in this whole Louisiana territory and the expedition right there. So that's how it's possible to suggest that that could have had a hand in the murder of Meriwether Lewis, whatever it was he discovered.
Wow. Yeah, fascinating. And again, this is all detailed in your two books on the subject, but I want to take it back to Napoleon and ask you, as far as what we can tell from his biographies and such, what was his occult interest? Was he possibly on the lookout for the Ark of the Covenant? And the reason I ask that is because recently I was listening to Patrice Chaplin's interview, and she's talking about Rennes-le-Château and how there's potentially this portal area in the vicinity, and it's created by a sort of structure, multiple structures sort of mirroring themselves, and it creates this pentagram on the landscape, and, you know, all well over my head, but apparently it's somehow related to the Ark of the Covenant and this potential to travel through time, travel to the other side of, you know, maybe the other side, you know, the other world, what underworld, however you want to imagine it. So was Napoleon in any way interested in these things, or was this all political, military power he was after?
Oh, politics and military adventurism do not explain Napoleon. Those were things that he, because he was good at one, he fell into the other and turned out to be not so bad at the other either. I don't know yet of any specific interest on his part of, say, the Ark of the Covenant or the Rennes Le Chateau portal thing. However, you'll find this interesting, and I talk about this in the first book, a little bit in the second one. We know Napoleon had a weird experience inside the pyramid when he was in Egypt. Okay. Real weird experience, which in Esoteric Napoleon Volume 1, I go into details as to what that could have been. And it could have had something to do with a psychotronic experience inside the pyramid where he got a glimpse, okay, interdimensionally, across time and space. Crazy as it sounds, I lay out how that could have been in the book. So would he have been interested in a portal? You betcha. Absolutely, in my opinion. Now, here's the interesting thing. I also talk about this in the first book. In the Rennes Le Chateau milieu, there is the Hopewell family, okay? Madame de Hopewell is the one whose grave marker, headstone, is mysteriously associated with the Rennes Le Chateau mystery, okay? Because it's the one with the Et in Arcadia ego phrase on it and the whole cross and the weird symbol. That if you know anything about the Father Sonnier mystery, you know who Madame de Hopewell is in the whole thing. What's interesting is, I believe he was a nephew, might have been a cousin, but a nephew, a blood relative who would have been, I'm pretty sure, a contemporary of hers, she would have known, was Colonel de Hopewell. And Colonel de Hopewell was a close confidant officer serving under Napoleon, who was on the Egyptian expedition and was present when the other guy, whose name I can't even think of off the top of my head, stumbled onto the Rosetta Stone, just sticking up in the sand. And the Rosetta Stone, turns out, is the same dimension as Madame de Hopewell's headstone. So you have a de Hopewell there, and the de Hopewells are neck deep in the Rennes Le Chateau mystery. You have him serving directly, a close, trusted officer of Napoleon Bonaparte. You have him right there on that expedition where Napoleon had the weird experience, and where all this amazing stuff was discovered, and he happens to be there when the Rosetta Stone is allegedly discovered. I argue in the book, I suggest in the book, that it was planted, that this was found elsewhere prior to that moment, and they decided, okay, here's how we'll announce the discovery of this. I also am convinced that Napoleon's savants translated the Rosetta Stone before the British got their hands on it, before any, you know, we're told between the French and the British who translated it later, we're told that story. Now, I think they translated it on the scene while in Egypt, and that provided them with the ability to find certain things that maybe we still don't know about, that might have even told them what Napoleon experienced in the pyramid, you know, described it. Because here's the interesting thing. Before going to Egypt, Napoleon, on his Italian campaign, they capture all this stuff, right? All these resources, assets, paintings, ancient, this, that, and the other. And they find is it an 11,000 or 1,100 year old? They find this parchment, this papyrus, okay? Maybe 1,100 years old at the time. I don't know. Off the top of my head, that's, you know, that's why I wrote it down, so I wouldn't have to remember. Anyway, we don't know to this day what was in that parchment. And it was brought to him by Gaspar Monge. Gaspar Monge was a geometrist of the day and a mason and kind of an alchemically hermetic science-minded guy and Napoleon Bonaparte's closest mentor. Okay? Now, he's also the discoverer, or the theoretist, or however you want to put it, of what's called the Monge point, What is the Monge point? In geometry, the Monge point is that point where all planes, possible planes of existence, intersect. Now, I propose in the Napoleon I book that the sarcophagus, the so-called sarcophagus in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, is the Monge point of the Great Pyramid. Oh, wait, I left out an important part. This Monge point, the intersection of all possible planes, physical planes, okay, in a pyramidal structure. In a pyramidal structure. So I argue that something in this papyrus, okay, which decoding the Rosetta Stone helped them translate, told Monge something about the Great Pyramid as a psychotronic device. He briefs Napoleon, has him spend a night in there. Napoleon has this wild experience.
Right.
Okay. He comes out visibly shaken. You know, a close guard, you know, a close person asks him, what happened? And he goes, you wouldn't believe me if I told you. That's the story. That's the legend. We know for a fact that he did spend the night in the pyramid. So yes, Napoleon would have been fascinated with the idea of a portal, some interdimensional portal. Absolutely, he would have been interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah. Wow. So all of this is taking place right at the birth of what we now think of as the United States, and Washington, D.C. was not what it was yet now. Right. Today. Was Pierre L'Enfant, the designer of Washington, D.C., was he privy to any of these sort of discoveries? Because I know that parts of Yale University were designed inspired by some of the discoveries of Napoleon's expedition. The Grove Street Cemetery across the street from Yale's campus was designed after the Hermopolis tomb.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think, and I always say his name again. I always stumble on it.
Oh, L'Enfant.
L'Enfant, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like in the word infant, but French.
Yeah, L'Enfant absolutely had to have been knowledgeable of this kind of thing, because look what he laid down on the ground and stuff in D.C.
Yeah.
Look what he designed. And then, you know, after, look what they expanded on and built upon it. So these are the kinds of things that a guy like him, yeah, would have been interested in, that would have flavored his perspective on the architecture. And we can't put it past, you know, those who hired him, you know, to say, hey, we want this to symbolize this, we want this to say that, long after we're gone, you know, lay it in the landscaping, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think that's something that knowledge of the an interest in these kinds of things certainly would have informed his designs there in DC.
Mm. Now, this experience that Napoleon had, mm-hmm. how in any way does this tie into your time travel research? I guess I ask this because I wonder if something like the pyramid can facilitate a state of consciousness that allows us to peer into the past or maybe even into our future.
Well, you're talking about basically what we popularly like to call remote viewing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Napoleon experienced. He had a what we would call a remote viewing experience, through which, you know, he looked through time and space, hypothetically. And I say that seriously. So I, in my book, The Time Travel Guidebook, I suggest that the first step in possible physical, actual time travel would be this visionary, this remote view of time and space, if you will, because it would be like a recon to where you're going. Okay. Now, I also propose that Napoleon saw some specific things about his future, or at least the potential of his future. So that's why he went forward with such confidence with certain things, right? So, I think that he remote viewed this. I think any human being is capable of, if they go in there and they knew what he knew, which I argue he was, again, he was briefed by Gaspar Monge, who understood this better. If you knew what Napoleon knew and you go there today and lay down in that sarcophagus in the king's chamber and the conditions are right, which I think these days are impossible because, you know, people only get like a minute to lay down in that thing and then they're moving them through. But anybody could possibly have the same experience. And there's been others who have reported strange experiences while laying in that sarcophagus. We say sarcophagus. We don't know. I don't think that's what that was, because I'm in that school of thought that the Great Pyramid was not a tomb.
Right. Right. It'd be a lot of wasted money and effort to make one giant sepulcher like that. Yeah, it's just ridiculous. Well, and this, you know, it's funny you say that, because right in your previous statement about the Egyptology as a field kind of starting with Napoleon, you have to wonder, like, is that why we have such a half-ass, excuse the expression, idea of what Egyptian history is? And it seems like, you know, Zahi Hawass is probably a good example of this, but they've just put puppets in this, you know, to go and lie to people about, oh, well, this happened. And, you know, Zahi's got like an infamous reputation at this point for stealing people's research and all this other stuff that he does to keep it in the domain of the authorized Egyptian version.
Well, I point to my current favorite villain. I say, don't blame France, blame England, because, you know, after, you know, English scientists and historians and Egyptologists, you know, they got their fingers in that pie, okay, and greatly controlled it, particularly after 1830, when the materialist bean counter specialists only scientists outnumbered the philosopher scientists, who were much more, had much greater comprehensive knowledge of the sciences and history. Okay. Right. The bean counting materialist scientists, the specialists, they hated those guys because those guys were smarter than they were. They were superior to them, intellect in every way. And what I'm talking about that happened in 1830 in the Royal Society, the way they went was the way all science in the West professionally went after that. That's why we're stuck with, you know, specialists, okay? Everybody's got to be a specialist. God forbid you're a generalist, okay? Because they can hide things. It's easier to hide things when you stay in your lane. You're just an archaeologist. We don't want you thinking about how archaeology might be informed by astronomy. We don't want, you know, how this science might be informed by this other one and give you a greater picture of what's really going on or what really happened. No, you stay in your lane because that's the way to go. So Zahi Hawass, in my opinion, is a product of that crap.
Yeah.
You know, and also protectionism of one's own stake or claim, you know, on the past. His Egyptian culture that he knows, they didn't build that Great Pyramid and they didn't build the Sphinx, and he darn well knows it, but he would, you know, he does things where he'd much rather have people conclude that, you know, that's the case. So it's what Western civilization has, you know, really greatly been doing, you know, protect its own interests, protect its own claim to greatness and ownership of things. Don't let anybody know what would contradict that, you know, the selected narrative. So, and look, after Napoleon, you know, went off the scene, England had their big stake in being, you know, the big number one in Western civilization. So they, you know, even to this day, a lot of them, they went on this campaign, you know, 2-century campaign that continues mostly, of slander against Napoleon Bonaparte. Oh, he was the Antichrist of Nostradamus. No, he wasn't. The guy who claimed that Nostradamus said that admitted in his own lifetime, this is like almost 100 years ago, he said, nah, you know what? My book and hypotheses were based on a very bad translation of Nostradamus. Nostradamus never really identified Napoleon, you know, this guy, Napoleon, that we, you know, Bonaparte that would come along as the Antichrist. That was all propaganda and lies.
Well, and Nostradamus is probably the most misquoted man in the Western civilization.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, every single thing that's happened since his lifetime was predicted by him, according to someone. So, yeah, it's a little crazy. Well, when it comes to Napoleon, he was certainly smeared. He had his enemies. He had the propaganda around him. But there seems to be, and I don't know if this is included because, forgive me, I haven't read the second one yet, but Napoleon's demise seems to be shrouded in mystery as well. Have you looked into, I'm sure you have, his brother and the possible switcheroo that took place when Napoleon was cast away on an island somewhere?
Well, the switch with his brother is a major part of the first volume, Esoteric Napoleon Volume 1. And again, that's not an idea I came up with. That is something that was suspected. Get this. It was suspected at the time Napoleon was fleeing France. The British suspected he was going to do that. Okay. And for the last 50 years or so, there have been scholars that are convinced he did it. Okay. What the record shows is that when they were in Rochefort, I screw up sometimes and say La Rochelle. No, it's Rochefort, I believe, was where they were at, a port city after they had to leave Malmaison because Paris and everything was being overrun. And Joseph, who he and Napoleon looked remarkably alike, so much so that Napoleon had used Joseph more than once as a double for security, because there had been so many attempts on his life, he started using a double, and he used his brother more than once as a double to, so that people after him would think, oh, that was him going in that carriage down the road, when actually he was going the opposite direction. So this was something they had already done to fool people. That's how much they resembled each other. Okay. Now remember, in those days, there wasn't photography. Okay. People didn't have photos everywhere to where, you know, a photo analysis, you'd go, hey, wait a minute, that's not exactly him. In those days, you know, it would have been even more convincing. So we know for a fact, because the witnesses later said it, wrote it, you know, at the time, we're talking 1815, Joseph begged Napoleon. He said, right now, there are two ships ready to take you to the United States. Okay. There is also an American frigate off the coast. Okay. That's ready to take you to the United States, either Boston Harbor or New York. And, or that's where the British assumed he was going to go. And we're told that Napoleon said, no, I'll trust the British to be gentlemen. They'll probably put me in a nice estate in the north of England and I'll live a good life. No, we're told that he turned down the offer to go to America, where he always wanted to go, okay, and where he was intending to go after Waterloo, and I'll tell you how we know this. We're told that he turned down Joseph's offer and trusted the British. No, here's the evidence that he did the switch, okay? Number one, it's also a documented fact that in the hurried days after Waterloo at Malmaison at the estate, he was gathering, okay, not just fancy dishes and things like that and clothes. He was gathering scientific expeditionary equipment. He was gathering certain books having to do with history, archaeology, that kind of thing. Okay. And what he was telling his people was, I'm going to spend the rest of my days exploring the Americas. Yeah. To heck with Europe. I'm done here in France. I'm going to do that. Scientific expedition. He said this. Okay. This is the stuff that he brought running from Paris to get away from the British and the Prussians. Okay. So here he has this opportunity to do this, and he's going to just suddenly go, nah, I'll live the rest of my life drinking tea and eating cakes in the north of England, which we know didn't happen. They didn't intend to do that. So the other thing is, there is a story that Joseph Bonaparte, who, again, this is history, we're told that Joseph Bonaparte, I'm doing the air quotes there, it came to live in the United States. Okay. That's history. And there was an incident on, I believe, in Philadelphia. He's walking down one of the boulevards in Philadelphia, and a gentleman who had been a personal guard of Napoleon walks up to him and says, "Mon Emperor," because a lot of Bonapartists fled to the United States after Waterloo. He said, "Mon Emperor, it's you." And we're told that Joseph said, "No, no, no, I'm Joseph. I'm not Napoleon. I'm not the emperor." And the guy says, "Mon Emperor, it's you. I know you, you know, basically I guarded you, you know." And Joseph's like, "No, no, no, Joseph." It's like almost comical,
right?
You know? So yeah. And that's just one example. There's reasons to, I think, argue that, yeah, Napoleon did the switch. Again, the British assumed he was going to do it. They sent two men of war, one to New York Harbor, one to Boston, convinced they were going to intercept it, which they didn't go there. It's possible they went to Baltimore Harbor or Norfolk instead. And Napoleon, in my opinion, lived the rest of his days, you know, before dying in France, because he eventually returned to France. You know, he's buried, Joseph and Napoleon, their crypts are in the Pantheon in Paris, where all the famous French, you know, legends are buried. I just argue that it's Napoleon and the one identified as Joseph, and vice versa. It's Joseph that's in Joseph's bones that's in Napoleon's box.
Wow.
But yeah, so I go into that more details in Esoteric Napoleon Volume 1.
Yeah.
And then there was another part to that question that you asked, the thing about did they switch, and I've forgotten what the other part was.
Huh. Yeah, maybe I did too. I think you
sorry about that.
No, well, you certainly satisfied the curiosity, the main point of curiosity there. But now I'm wondering, because I heard that Bonaparte settled somewhere in New Jersey, and if his body is indeed in France now, then where did his collection end up? Did he donate his library to a university or somewhere, some benefactor that, you know, holds it in an archive somewhere?
Yeah, that I'm trying to find the final answer on that as well.
Mm.
There's one particular artifact I talk about in the first book, which I'm going to do a follow-up book on that particular thing, researching that, because I have some suspicions about what it was. And we know where that particular artifact is today, if I'm right that that was it. I don't want to give too much away. But there are others. Like, where was the, who got the papyrus? You know, the 1,100-year-old papyrus that Monge brought to him, that might have given the secrets to the Great Pyramid or what have you. Where did, you know, possibly some other things, you know, go? That's a very good question. You know, it's also very possible, and I go into the details in the book, that Napoleon's money funded the foundation of the Smithsonian Institution.
Wow.
That organization, that establishment was his idea, a concept that he would have proposed. And in the book, I go into the details as to how it's very possible that Napoleon's money, we're talking after 1815, when he's living as Joseph, you know, so it's real interesting. I, you know, going back to the Rennes-le-Château thing, I do suspect that the big secret about Rennes-le-Château that Saunière found had more to do with Napoleon's lineage than it did anything to do with Christ, you know. And, you know, maybe this has been out there too. It's not original with me, but if Napoleon really was the Merovingian heir, and I go into this in Napoleon I, if he was the true Merovingian heir, then he would have, by their own rules, had the oldest and first claim to the thrones of most of Europe anyway. And that might have been why they hated him and why they were afraid of him seizing power. And that might have been why it was so valuable to Saunière. Because think about it. In the late 19th century, there would have still been concern over a Bonaparte descendant. Okay. So it could have been, that information could have been very valuable if Saunière found something to do with tying Napoleon to the bloodline of Mary Magdalene, whoever, whatever she actually was. Wow. So it could have had as much or more to do with Napoleon than it ever did, you know, Christ. Certainly, you know, the Magdalene connection could still be there, but
yeah,
you know,
that's fascinating. Yeah, it really is at the heart of possibly the biggest mystery in Western civilization. So, yeah, and Napoleon, you know, aside from the, you know, obviously proven fake Nostradamus prophecy, he did have this larger than life capacity. And, you know, I think with certain figures in history, they might be viewed with rose-colored glasses afterwards, but there seems to be divine provenance in the life of Napoleon and other great men who, you know, maybe it has something to do with their bloodline, but they change the world in a major way. Yeah. They're not always loved, and they possibly have these deeper connections. I think it's fascinating. Now, on the point of Rennes Le Chateau, there is the thread that connects it to the New World and the idea that some of the plants depicted inside of the church were actually from the New World. Is this connected possibly to like John Cabot and like this thread of, you know, on St. Brendan, these kind of early explorers that came before Columbus and might have taught this stuff to your, you know, people in the Old World?
Well, you're talking about like the corn, the ear of corn thing.
I think
or
that's
whatever.
One of them. Now, yeah.
Are we mixing up the Rennes Le Chateau with the Rosslyn Chapel, which
that's,
is in the mix of the Rennes Le Chateau mystery?
I am mixing it up. I am.
Yeah, but you're not completely off, because there is that Templar association with the Rennes Le Chateau mystery and the Rosslyn Chapel connection to it. But to be specific, yeah, in Rosslyn Chapel, yeah, of course it's knowledge of the Americas. I mean, the Fourth Crusade that was in the 13th or 12th century. Okay, they were supposed to go sack, you know, the Holy Land again, but oops, they decided to stop at Istanbul, Constantinople, and, you know, sack their own rival Christian empire, right? And so one of the things they sacked were the archives, which was the Alexandrian library of Constantinople of its day. And it had some of the things that you would find in the Library of Alexandria. So this was sacked, and long story short, one of the beneficiaries of this ancient knowledge, like maps, portolans, charts, which would have been of the New World, one of the beneficiaries was the Knights Templar. Even though they refused to participate in the combat of the Fourth Crusade, they provided some resources, particularly some naval resources. And they would have been the beneficiaries of what was seized. And the hypothesis is that they got knowledge of the Americas. So in, you know, 13th, 14th centuries, they're going off to the Americas, right? And learning, wow, there is a whole new world over here. And the idea is that by the time of Columbus, it was decided by the powers that be that had the knowledge that it was time to open up the Americas, because finally, to really reap the resources, we need the manpower. And so we need thousands of people, millions of people to go over there. So then we've got the manpower to make them work this, make them work. You know, that's the hypothesis. So it was a staged event, Columbus discovering the New World. So this is why I think, and others think, in Rosslyn Chapel, you have things that are clearly of the Americas. You have allusions in paintings and art that gets associated with the Rennes Le Chateau mystery, like Nicolas Poisson's Three Shepherds painting, Et in Arcadia Ego. Remember, that phrase is on Madame de Hautpoul's gravestone, which is at the heart of the Rennes Le Chateau mystery. Well, here's an interesting thing. Nicolas Poisson's descendant, okay, also named Poisson, was a cartographer and engineer, you know, okay, a guy that's into landscapes and maps and cartography, also named Poisson. And lo and behold, he was a trusted Bonapartist officer under Napoleon. So there you have two of the families, the heart of the Rennes Le Chateau mystery, right there with the family connection to Napoleon directly. And Poisson's one of those Bonapartists that after 1815 comes to the United States, ends up being a cartographer engineer for the U.S. Army, and is all over the Louisiana Territory. Wow. After that. This was years after the the Lewis and Clark expedition, but still, you have to wonder. It's argued that Nicolas Poisson, centuries before, in his paintings, showed landscapes that could possibly have been in the Americas, but this was before he could have known this, according to what we know about history. However, if he had a Templar association, and got information about certain landscapes, if the Templars, say, were building things or hiding things over there, Poisson's paintings could have been code, something along those lines. There's all sorts of possibilities. Again, I go into that in Esoteric Napoleon Volume 1 and my book Secret Missions 5, Veiled Destinies. I go into it a lot in there.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that as we wrap up here. Where is the best place for people to find your books? I noticed that not all of them are easily tracked down, and some of them are on Amazon, it looks like, through secondhand sellers. Yeah. So is there a better place to find your books? And do you have any intention of maybe publishing like digital copies, ebooks, things like that?
Digital, no. They're too easy to... for people to rip Steel. Off. I quit doing the digital books a while back, but walterbosley.com is where you can find all my books.
Right.
Excuse me. Walterbosley.com. And they're all there now. You do find some, out there, but you're going to pay more. The best price is at walterbosley.com. So that's where I'd recommend people go.
And I'm glad you clear that up, because we do want people to support you directly and not go and, put money in Amazon's pocket when they can buy it from you directly. So,
And a word on that. Amazon takes the lion's share. The authors make such a small, piddly little amount that whenever an author is selling their books through some other means, try to avoid the Amazon avenue, because by avoiding Amazon, you're helping the author.
Yeah. And your books are great quality too. If anybody was worried about that, sometimes you get a self-published book and it's not exactly what you're expecting, but not the case at all with yours. They're, I think, better in some ways. They're pleasant on the eyes.
I've been a publisher for 23 years on now, and I've published several other authors. So my publishing label is it's a small press, micro press, but I've always done a professional, legitimate job. People see the books, how my printer does them, how they distribute it, and they assume that it's a bigger company than it is.
Oh, well,
and I'm very proud of that, because I do put out a quality product, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasant read for sure. I think nowadays, the type font or the typeset, there's something different about some of the major publishers, and your reading your books reminds me of when I was a kid and you'd find like those thick paperbacks with a little bigger font, but it's a lot better for the experience. So I do
like the older fonts. You've noticed that. I use Times New Roman for pretty much my nonfiction. But I'll use some of the other older fonts for fiction, especially because I publish classic reprints like Talbot Mundy books. Now, those you can find at lulu.com, the fiction stuff.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, I'll plug that real quick. I did a series of Mundy books, which I'm very proud of if you're into lost civilizations and adventure. This is the guy whose works greatly went into the inspiration for Indiana Jones type adventure fiction. But this is the series of Talbot Mundy books that I have published, and I'm really proud of this series. It looks like there's one more up there, but it looks like a nice set on the shelf and stuff like that. And speaking of the old fonts, it's got one of the old fonts. But anyway, shameless plug for some of my other products. Sorry.
no shame at all. And in that vein, you aren't just writing excellent books, you're also publishing your own podcast, which people can find on the traditional platforms, on your website, and also on YouTube. You have a YouTube channel where you post regularly, and it looks like we don't have time to get into this, but maybe as a sort of teaser for people, tell us what you're getting into with this California series, and maybe folks can go and check that out after they finish this episode.
California was conceived by my associate and friend Todd Wood. Long story short, he was doing some great research for like a year, sharing it with me. And I said, Todd, this is a few years back, said, Todd, you ought to write a book. And he says, well, I would, but I'm legally blind. And I had no idea. I'm like, what? I go, you do amazing research for a guy. He goes, yeah, I have a hard time. He goes, I have to expand the screen. Really? I'm like, well, Todd, I'm really impressed. So again, another long story short, I said, I'll tell you what, you do the research, provide me with the info. I'll do the actual writing and we'll collaborate that way. So we've done that on a couple of books, and he's really fascinated with the serial killer cases. So he came to me and said, hey, I got this idea, you know, we could do this episode and that. So I'm like, well, heck yeah, let's do it. So that was Todd's idea, and we're very happy to facilitate it, because it's some of the most popular episodes and topics that I've ever run on the Walter Bosley channel over there at YouTube. So yeah, I recommend it. It's one of our more popular things, and for anybody to go check out over there, because there's a whole playlist of California episodes.
Right on. Well, Walter, I really appreciate your time. All of what we discussed is going to be linked in the episode description, and the audience can go and check everything out there. So thank you again. And to everyone tuning in, support Walter in his work. And until next episode, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. All right. That was our second conversation with Walter Bosley. If you're new to the show or started listening within the past year or so, I highly recommend you go back into the back catalogs and listen to some of our older episodes where Walter Bosley has joined us before. We covered his first three books in the Empire of the Wheel series, the first two, and then Latitude 33, which deals with the strange anomalies over there in Anaheim, California, at Disney, and so much more. Walter Bosley's a wealth of information. He's got his own YouTube channel and, of course, his website where all of his books are available. Buy them from him to support him directly and support us here on the show if you want to see more incredible investigations into topics like the ones Walter presents on his channel and in his books. We've got some really great guests on the way, and you'll get early access to future episodes now if you sign up on patreon.com/mftic. That's patreon.com/mftic. You support the show for just $2 a month or $3 a month, $5 a month. Each tier, as you go higher, gets you more benefits, more rewards. But if you really just want to get your money's worth for that $2 tier, you can get the entire ad-free version of the podcast and never have to listen to me plugging anything else ever again. You just get exactly what you came for, which is this show, my thoughts, and most importantly, the fascinating topics that we hear about when we interview these great guests like Walter Bosley. If you want to see who we have coming up soon, some new guests that have never been on the show before, some returning guests who I know are favorites for people who listen, fans of the show who've listened for a while. So be on the lookout later this week for new episodes, and sign up now on patreon.com to get a sneak preview or early access to some of those episodes. And until next episode, thank you for listening. Immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. MFTIC. Broadcasting the moon matrix from the lunar surface. They want you confused like you never knew your purpose. Hopping through the portals, dismantling the machine. My family thinks I'm crazy, I can't believe what I've seen. Memories of a war, the Pleiadians and Anunnaki. Stuck within the genes of a copy of a human body. DNA fractal, the universe within me. Epiphanies of science is hoarded by the Illuminati. Puppet masters, no, the power.
power of the mantra. Repeating mad lies till it has an effect on ya. Subliminal messages hijack your perception. Tricking the population with holographic projections. We see through it. The system is unraveling. I'm astral traveling through the library of the Vatican on a sacred journey. I embark with the squad for rougher spitting truth like Mark on the pod. Gotta know the facts, never hold back. Cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers. Searching through the galaxy, you might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade. I awoke in a deep underground military base. Zero recollection of how I got to this place. Alien corpses floating in glass cylinders. Must have been extracted when they crashed into us. Animal hybrids contained in the cages. A lion with the eagle head. Monkeys with reptilian faces. Losing my mind and I'm feeling desperate. I look around the room and I see no sign of an exit. All of a sudden the wall flickers away, revealing a hangar full of spacecraft. My getaway, I run to the nearest one. See a guard knock him out, robbing for his plasma gun. Hop in the ship, take the controls. They highly intuitive, I figure it out easily. Lift off, accelerate through a tunnel until I see the light. Fly into the sky, get flanked by six F-35s. Gotta know the facts, never hold back. Cause I ain't getting caught up in the soul trap. I dissect the fabric of reality, looking for the answers. Searching through the galaxy, you might be feeling stressed out. Depression, anxiety is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. You don't even know how powerful you are. We the ones who gonna expose the whole facade.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.